From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, some of the ethical and legal dilemmas surrounding advanced reproductive technologies. We talk with bioethicist Lori Andrews about the sale of sperm over the internet, seeding pregnancies from the eggs of female fetuses, custom-ordered, genetically improved designer babies, and more. Her new book is The Clone Age. Also, commentator Milo Miles reviews the new album by Olivia Tremor Control. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Senate is voting on a series of measures aimed at closing loopholes in the law controlling gun purchases. Senators voted overwhelmingly to ban the sale of semi-automatic assault weapons to minors and to prohibit minors from possessing high-capacity ammunition clips. They then approved an amendment by California Democrat Dianne Feinstein to ban the importation of high-capacity ammunition clips, a provision that had failed in previous years. Senate Republican leaders have also said they'll reconsider yesterday's vote against requiring background checks for people who buy firearms privately at gun shows. Some Republican senators complained about the measure, and President Clinton accused the Republicans of passing up a chance to save lives. Mary Robinson, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, has ended a tour of countries affected by the Kosovo conflict without being granted a meeting with Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic. NPR's Silvia Poggioli reports from Belgrade.
Before Mary Robinson began her mission, human rights activists had expressed concern about her meeting Slobodan Milosevic. They feared it would legitimize the man NATO holds responsible for the forced displacement of hundreds of thousands of Albanians from Kosovo. Mary Robinson, however, lamented that she was prevented from reporting directly to Milosevic about what she'd been told by refugees in Macedonia, Albania, and Montenegro. And she was scathing in her appeal to the Yugoslav government to put an end to ethnic cleansing in Kosovo, which she said has inflicted terrible and cruel suffering on Kosovo Albanians. But she also criticized the impact of NATO bombs on civilians and wondered why there are so many innocent victims of the sophisticated weaponry NATO is using in its air campaign against Yugoslavia. This is Silvia Poggioli, NPR News, Belgrade.
Russia's lower house of parliament has held the first day of impeachment hearings amid a new government crisis. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
Yeltsin's accusers said he should be held responsible for the collapse of the Soviet Union, for the war in Chechnya, and his 1993 crackdown on parliament. He's also accused of genocide for destroying the lives of millions with his economic reforms and of failing to provide for the military. Yeltsin's representative, Alexander Kachinkov, called the case groundless, and he argued that during next year's presidential elections, Russians will be able to see a peaceful handover of power. But lawmakers, angry over Yeltsin's sudden decision to fire Prime Minister Yevgeny Primakov, are likely to pass at least one impeachment charge. The article of impeachment would then have to be approved by the upper house and the courts, and this is unlikely. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Moscow.
The Dow posted another record high today. This is NPR. A federal jury in Kansas City, Missouri, found today that Brown & Williamson Tobacco Corporation was not liable for the death of a long-term Kool smoker who died from lung cancer. And the family of the smoker, Charles Steele, sued the cigarette company for $26 million, charging that Brown & Williamson had sold Steele an unreasonably dangerous product. The jury found that Steele was aware of the dangers of smoking, but continued anyway. Lawyers for Brown and Williamson had argued that Steele never tried to quit smoking and that he was exposed to other cancer-causing substances in his jobs at an aluminum foundry and a brick factory. Lawyers for a key government witness in the Oklahoma City bombing trials have asked a panel of judges from the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals to grant their client a lighter sentence, NPR's Mark Roberts reports.
Federal prosecutors promised Michael Fortier that they would recommend leniency if he would testify against his friend Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols. Fortier took the witness stand in the trials of both men, describing how McVeigh told him of his plans to bomb the Murrah Federal Office Building and how Nichols had helped out. Fortier was later sentenced to 12 years in prison for transporting stolen weapons, lying to the FBI, and knowing about the bomb plot and failing to warn authorities. Fortier's lawyers argued that the sentencing judge was wrong when he concluded that money Fortier made from selling stolen weapons was used to finance the bombing. And since he cooperated with the government, his sentence should be no more than 33 months. But prosecutor Sean Connolly argued that Fortier deserves the 12-year prison sentence for his lesser role in the crime. Mark Roberts, NPR News, Denver.
The S&P 500 gained more than 3 points today for a record high. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. The latest news in genetic testing, announced Tuesday in the Journal of the American Medical Association, is that it's now possible to screen embryos for sickle cell genes. A New York couple have become the first to successfully employ the expensive experimental procedure. The woman recently gave birth to healthy twins. This breakthrough, like so many in the field of reproductive technology, raises difficult legal and ethical questions. Do only genetically approved children deserve to be born? Will only the wealthy have access to genetic screening for their children? Could a child sue a hospital for malpractice if the child were born with a disease-carrying gene which was missed in screening? These are the kinds of issues that Lori Andrews explores in her new book, The Clone Age: Adventures in the New World of Reproductive Technology. Lori Andrews is the director of the Institute for Science, Law, and Technology and a professor at Chicago Kent College of Law. She's advised Congress, the World Health Organization, and the National Institutes of Health on genetics and biotechnology. I asked her to explain why the practice of reproductive medicine is unregulated, unlike most other medical specialties.
Well, unlike new drugs or devices, new reproductive technologies are not covered by the Food and Drug Administration, which doesn't regulate doctors' services. But also, this is a unique area in that there are no federal research funds available for in vitro fertilization and its variants. Because of the opposition from pro-life groups, there's been no governmental funding. That means that, unlike every other medical technology, it hasn't gone through a research phase that required it to get advanced review, to have sufficient animal research first, to monitor the informed consent. They just plunge in and offer these new technologies to paying patients.
Now, does an infertility clinic, a doctor, have to get some kind of board certification to practice?
Absolutely not. And that's been a big problem with respect to fertility drugs, where any general practitioner can give these drugs, even though you really need certain equipment to monitor to make sure that there aren't too many eggs that are released leading to multiple births.
You cite a common technique now as an example of a new technique that's being widely used without sufficient advanced study. It's called ICSI, intracytoplasmic sperm injection, in which a woman's eggs are harvested and then directly injected in vitro with their partner's sperm. What are the red flags?
Well, one thing that's happened is that it's very satisfying to do ICSI for the doctors. It's sort of like having sex under the microscope. They take an individual sperm and stick it into an egg rather than putting an egg in the petri dish with thousands of sperm around it. And so that's allowed men with very, very low sperm counts to be able to procreate. But it is so easy to do that they're using it in many more instances, and about one-third of the in vitro fertilizations going on in the country actually use ICSI. Follow-up studies, though, in Europe, in Australia, have found that the children born have an increased rate of chromosomal abnormalities. There are some developmental disabilities at the age one, for example. And The Lancet, the British medical journal, has suggested that ICSI was used prematurely in humans before enough animal research was done. And I think that's the case of many of the infertility technologies. There wasn't a sufficient amount of animal research first.
So this is another part of the argument why these reproductive technologies should be under the arm or the guidance of the NIH.
Yes, or at least have some requirement for institutional review boards. Senator John Glenn actually had proposed in Congress that the laws governing advanced scrutiny and informed consent in research should apply to everybody and not just people using federal funds. But that law was not passed, and so clinics aren't covered by it.
Let's look then at multiple births. We've had the record-breaking septuplets, now the octuplets in recent years. Rather than calling it a medical miracle, you stated in your opinions that it's closer to medical malpractice.
Yes, I think it's a tremendous public health problem, multiple births. Right now, 1.3 million fertility drug prescriptions are filled each year at the cost of $230 million. And for example, there are as many quadruplets born every year in the United States as there were in the first 50 years of this century. So it's become really quite common to have twins or triplets, and yet the long-term medical problems for these children can be great. The risk to women are high of the fertility drugs of multiple births, risks such as potentially fatal blood clots, diabetes, hemorrhaging, heart failure. Now the FDA requires warnings on the fertility drugs that they may potentially be linked to ovarian cancer, and yet we're not scrutinizing it. Think about it. If there were some other medical emergency that was causing death in 16% of a group of children, we would be looking into it. But 16% of the children in multiple births die within the first month after birth, as did one of the octuplets, and we're in part, you know, turning a blind eye to it.
Is there a financial incentive for the infertility clinics to go ahead and implant as many embryos as possible, to use the more aggressive drugs, more aggressive therapies in order to drive up their success rates?
Absolutely. If you look at Sunday newspaper magazines, they often have ads for infertility clinics. The clinics compete by success rate. You know, say a clinic has 200 patients. Well, if 50 of those patients have triplets, you've got 150 babies across 200 patients. It seems like a very high success rate, and they're not disclosing that it's a lot of babies to a small number of women.
Also, though, on the other hand, there's an incentive for a woman to authorize the implantation of many embryos in order to increase the success of the procedure, which is very painful. It's very hard to go through. And you don't want to do it two or three times.
Sure, and some women have a kind of lottery mentality where if they don't get pregnant on the first or second attempt, they really want a lot of embryos implanted, you know, in the third attempt in order to try to get pregnant. I think the funding of reproductive services also plays a part. There are only a dozen states that where insurers are required to cover in vitro fertilization, and most of them have limits. Some say, for example, the woman can only use three attempts. And so if you're on your third attempt, you may ask your doctor, you know, to go for broke, implant eight embryos, even though you may end up with quintuplets.
What do you recommend then? I think in other countries, in Britain, for instance, there's a law limiting the number of embryos that may be implanted at one time, limiting it to three.
I think that would be appropriate here, to have some sort of law that limits to three or four embryos the number that can be implanted. Right now, there's a voluntary guideline from the American Society of Reproductive Medicine that says just that, only implant three or four. And yet doctors are routinely violating that. If you look at the statistics that are reported to the Centers for Disease Control, it's clear some clinics are still implanting seven or more embryos. Now, there is a new technology that's being developed where they implant embryos at a later stage called the blastocyst stage, when they're a little bigger, a little further along. And it looks like there's a higher pregnancy rate with that. And so if physicians can start using blastocysts instead of the early stage embryos, they may not have to put so many in, and there may not be as much of a possibility of multiple births. Another thing, though, that we can do is to not let just everybody prescribe fertility drugs, but only allow specialists to do it who have the equipment and the knowledge to do the kind of monitoring that is required to make sure that multiple pregnancies are less likely to occur.
I'm speaking with Lori Andrews. She's a professor at Chicago Kent College of Law and the director for the Institute for Science, Law, and Technology. She has a new book about genetic technology, reproductive technology. It's called The Clone Age. There have been a number of controversial cases in recent years in which sperm has been harvested from the bodies of men who are either incapacitated, comatose, or recently dead. In some cases, of course, the sperm has been harvested by family members without explicit permission of the man in question. You've been called in to assess the rights and the liabilities in these situations. What issues have come into play in sorting out the legalities of what you call procreation without permission?
Yes, I mean, I think the whole procedure is morally akin to rape, to take sperm from men in comas to create children. But we don't have really good legal precedents. For example, if a man dies, should his wife be allowed to create a child with the man's sperm? Right now, under the organ transplant laws, the wife, as the next of kin, can control giving the man's kidney to someone else unless he's refused that procedure before he died. And so, technically, under the organ transplant laws, she would be allowed to donate sperm to herself. But she seems to be in a conflict of interest situation there. And in fact, in some of the instances in which I've been called in, the men have said, told all their friends they didn't want to have a child with, say, this wife of the second marriage. And yet the wife makes the claim that he changed his mind right before his death or right before he went into a coma. So how should we judge that? There's another complexity, which is sometimes it's not the wife, but it's the parents of the man in a coma, and he may be a young man of, say, 17, who want the sperm and are going to use it to impregnate a surrogate mother to create their own grandchild. Now, culturally, you know, grandparents have no right to tell their children to give them grandchildren, and yet we're seeing more and more situations in which they are allowed to harvest sperm. In one case in Milwaukee, a man froze sperm before he underwent cancer chemotherapy. He wanted to use it when he recovered from the chemotherapy, which would make him sterile. He wanted to use it to create his own child. He died. The hospital gave the sperm to his parents, who are now interviewing single women, married women. They want to create as many grandchildren as possible. And yet I can't imagine that this man wanted his seed spread all over the state of Wisconsin.
Is there even a protocol for this technique? Do doctors have to consult with an ethics committee to untangle some of these requests?
No, it's totally ad hoc. Physicians can make their own decisions about whether they feel comfortable harvesting sperm from dead men or men in comas. Occasionally they have loose guidelines. One doctor in California says, well, I don't do it for men who have had vasectomies because I think that's proof that they didn't want children. But how can he tell that the men without vasectomies would have wanted children after they died? Even if they were trying to have children while alive, you know, they may have wanted children they could interact with and touch and play with and feel differently about being a daddy after death. I think there's also an interesting equal rights argument that will come up, where men might say, I would like to have eggs retrieved from my comatose wife and implanted in a surrogate mother. Because if women have the right to get sperm from comatose men, why not turn the tables? We might even see an instance where a man goes to court to get the right to impregnate his comatose wife, keep her alive on a respirator until she delivers the baby. There have been two cases where women in comas have been raped and kept alive until the baby was born. So all these things are technically possible, and one of the things that, you know, I'm asking is, you know, shouldn't we be having some advanced debate now that science fiction is turning into science fact, and see where we should draw the line?
My guest is Lori Andrews. She is a professor at Chicago Kent College of Law. She's also served as an advisor on genetic and reproductive technology to international health organizations, to Congress, and to foreign governments. Her new book is The Clone Age. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with lawyer and ethicist Lori Andrews. Her new book is The Clone Age, Adventures in the New World of Reproductive Technology. I read in your book that a Georgia sperm bank is selling franchises to drugstores, and the idea is that they will install liquid nitrogen tanks in the pharmacies and give the drugstore a cut of every fee they obtain for the sperm. Now, are there any laws standing in the way of sperm banks being open for business at your local Rite Aid?
There aren't many. I mean, some states do regulate tissue donation at some level, or at least require AIDS screening on sperm. But I do envision a time where, you know, single women can run in for a pack of Marlboros and some sperm. We already have sperm banks that will Federal Express sperm to women all over the country whose biological clocks are ticking and who want to make a decision about sperm donation. The downside is that sometimes the women may be ordering sperm, even over the internet, without the donor being properly screened, without knowing what her legal rights are in that particular state, and, you know, without the kind of psychological counseling that lets her know what it will be like to become a mother in this fashion.
Is that what you consider the contribution of the internet at this point to reproductive technology? It's increasing the risks?
It is, in fact, now. In Great Britain, for example, you can't pay egg donors. And so men are shipping their sperm to an egg donation clinic in the United States where it's made into an embryo and is expressed back to them. So it's become more of a direct marketing, often without physicians involved. You can go on the internet and choose a donor based on pages and pages of information, a photo and audio tape of the particular individual. And, you know, you've cut, you know, doctors out of the market sometimes, and you're really not sure what you're getting. Is that actually the donor's picture? Is it, you know, has there been screening and so forth? It certainly has changed the nature of reproductive technologies because it allows direct marketing. I read an ad recently where a woman was saying Jewish egg donor, great genes, and so forth, and it took me aback because of all the abuses that have been done in the name of genetics against the Jewish community. To be a woman, you know, running an ad for herself with the benefit of her genes seemed totally troublesome.
What legal precedents do you draw from then in the law if the reproductive technology industry is so firmly based in the marketplace? Are there protections, consumer protections that exist for women who, for instance, choose to become egg donors?
I think that increasingly we're seeing almost product liability precedents being used where one couple sued a sperm bank because the children weren't as handsome as they thought they should have been. And so the expectations are rising. You know, for example, if a woman chooses sperm from a Nobel Prize sperm bank, will she be disappointed if the child isn't doing algebra by kindergarten? Will there be a lawsuit there? The problem, I think, is the difference between law and medicine, where medicine looks ahead and law really looks back to precedent. When it had the first case about a car, it applied precedents about horse and buggies. But I'm not sure where to look for questions of who should get custody of a frozen embryo. Should we be able to put genes in embryos to give children traits they never had before? And the problem is this is decided on a state level. Some courts, for example, decide that embryos are people. Other courts decide that they are property. And so you not only have the problem of picking a legal category, but the fact that it differs from state to state. And I think we need to almost start afresh. There's an effort going on now between the American Bar Association, the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, the Food and Drug Administration, and others to come up with a uniform law in this area to maybe settle once and for all who the legal parents are, what sort of psychological and medical screening should be done, and to provide a roadmap and a way to protect these 75,000 children a year being born through these technologies.
Don't you foresee, though, the specter of the abortion debate rising, sending its shadow across that national discussion?
Absolutely. Already in Louisiana, where they have a law saying that an in vitro embryo is a person and cannot be terminated, one justice of the Louisiana Supreme Court said to me, that's just a Trojan horse to get in through the back door of the abortion debate. Because if you make an 8-cell embryo a person that can't be terminated, how can you stop then considering a 3-month-old fetus in a woman a person as well? And so I think you're right. There'll be some paralysis. There already are protests and sit-ins at some in vitro clinics, as we see at the abortion clinics, because there's this sense that embryos are not being allowed to flourish. Part of it is that in vitro fertilization only has a 25% success rate, so only 1/4 of the embryos turn into children. Now that, in the context of the abortion debate, may look like we are treating badly the other three quarters. What isn't taken into consideration is that even in natural reproduction, a baby isn't created every time egg meets sperm. Only about 30% of the time is a child created. And so this isn't really about embryo loss or treating embryos badly. It is a very close approximation to Mother Nature.
A new controversial alternative to donor eggs is this process of using female fetuses from abortions as a source of eggs for infertile women, since a 20-week-old fetus already has the maximum number of eggs it would have. One opponent of this technique in British Parliament said it was akin to rag dolls, to making babies from discarded bits of humanity. What do you foresee the legal implications of this new twist in the technology to be?
Well, there are questions about legal parenthood. If at some level the genetic mother has already died, was aborted before the child was even conceived, you know, how do you figure out legal motherhood, inheritance rights, who the parents are? And also, since a fetus might have as many as a million eggs, say, there'll be the tendency to use a great number of them, and what are the risks that the children created might intermarry? For example, if you start choosing a particular fetus as an egg donor for many women, there are potential problems of the psychological impact on the child of realizing that their biological mother never lived. And there are also questions of financial incentives. Will women get pregnant just to abort to sell the eggs? You know, if the going rate on eggs is between $2,500 and $5,000, this would be a new way to make money.
Where does the science stand on this? Is this technique near completion?
It is being done in animals, and I think in the human component has been limited, somewhat by this debate in the British Parliament suggesting it was totally inappropriate. In the United States, we have 25 states that have limits or bans on fetal research, and this would be considered fetal research. So that is one area where, unlike most of reproductive technologies, which deal with the embryo and are very loosely regulated, you know, we do have some breaks in place. Yet, so many other technologies are available, you know, using sperm from dead men, even companies being set up to clone human beings, that I think we can learn from what's happening with fetal egg donation, where we have put the brakes on it.
Lori Andrews is a bioethicist and professor at Chicago Kent College of Law. Her new book is The Clone Age. We'll hear more of our conversation in the second half of the show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, by Saab, designing cars with a philosophy that performance and safety go hand in hand, information available at www.saabusa.com, and by the National Endowment for the Humanities, expanding American understanding of human experience and culture. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Milo Miles reviews the latest album from Olivia Tremor Control and the ethical and legal implications of cloning. We continue our conversation with Lori Andrews, author of The Clone Age. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. We're continuing our conversation about reproductive technologies with lawyer and medical ethicist Lori Andrews. She heads the Institute for Science, Law, and Technology at Chicago Kent College of Law. Her new book is The Clone Age.
Have you seen patterns in the way that the public responds to, and the legal community responds to, new reproductive technologies? And does it follow this recognizable curve in the last 20-odd years from shock to acceptance as each new technology comes into the public eye?
Absolutely. I think in the 1960s, in some of the infertility books I was reading at that time, they suggested that first there's shock, and then there's negation, and then you form a commission to study it, and then there's gradual acceptance. And that was true about artificial insemination. In the 1960s, when it was first coming into widespread use in the United States, a law was proposed in Ohio to put everybody in jail, the sperm donor, the doctor, the lawyer, for doing it. That law never passed. Now artificial insemination is routine, but it took, you know, several decades to get accepted. In vitro, when it was first proposed in the United States, again, there were laws to limit it. It got accepted over a period of years. What is shocking me is how quickly we move from horror to acceptance. I think we've moved very quickly in the cloning area, and scientists that 2 years ago were saying to me, oh, I would never clone a human, are now saying, well, we should really consider what's really wrong about it. And I think that it suggests that we need to think about the criteria we're using. I think reproductive rights do cover things like using in vitro fertilization, which allows you to have a genetic child, which you then, you know, raise as any other family would. But that's much different than cloning, you know, creating a duplicate, which is a right people never had in the past and shouldn't come within this reproductive freedom right.
You've said that cloning, in your mind, or the best analogy to cloning, is that of incest.
Well, scientists have said to me repeatedly, oh, you can't put any limits on reproduction, so we should be allowed to clone. And I said, of course we put limits. We limit incest. We say that's too much power of parents over children. And I think cloning is similar in that you're exercising total control over the type of child that you would have. And there are huge risks. In cattle cloning, for example, the offspring had, in many cases, enlarged hearts, had diabetes. 20% of the cloned cattle died shortly after birth. And even if the physical risks were minimized, I think there are enormous psychological risks to the cloned child. If we clone a famous basketball player and the child breaks his knee at age 10, will he consider himself a failure? One lawyer has said that cloning puts your child in a kind of genetic bondage because you have certain expectations that you will then, you know, pressure the child to comply with.
What laws do exist on the books making cloning illegal?
In California, Michigan, Rhode Island, there are laws banning cloning, but it's interesting because they may be becoming obsolete because of the technology. For example, California prohibits making a clone by taking genetic material and putting it into a human egg. Some scientists, though, are saying we could use a cow egg as a kind of incubator for a human clone, put human genetic material into that cow egg, create a clone, and that wouldn't fall within the California ban. So we've got science moving very rapidly and the law racing to catch up with it.
So science is constantly creating its own loopholes.
Right, right. Without even the help from lawyers to create these loopholes. Across the globe, though, many other nations have signed on to treaties to ban human cloning and, you know, really see it as science run amok with all the health problems and so forth that we have. It doesn't seem that we need human cloning to be able to provide, you know, babies even for infertile couples. There's certainly a lot of other technologies with egg, sperm, surrogate mothers, and so forth, to create children for those who, you know, very much want them and value them.
In your research on cloning, you visited a cult in Canada. Is it pronounced the Raelians?
Yes, and I interviewed Rael, who has set up a company called CloneAid, where for $200,000, they are offering to clone people. They have 100 people on their waiting list. Some are infertile couples. Some are gay men who want to use cloning to have a child. And, you know, they really, you know, believe that we should go, you know, full speed ahead. They're also planning to offer a service called Clone a Pet. And I actually think there'll be much more of a demand for people to clone their pets, who, you know, always seem to be much nicer and loving to you often than children who you have less control over at some level. Indeed, one couple have given $2.3 million to Texas A&M University to clone their dog Missy in something called the Missiplicity Project. But the fact that, you know, this animal research is going on is going to make it much more likely that the jump will occur to humans within our lifetime.
Well, the central tenet of their religion is thou shalt clone.
Yes. I mean, they actually have believed since the 1970s that everybody on Earth was the product of cloning from an earlier alien culture. And so they see no religious objections to cloning because, in fact, it's been part of their dogma for many years.
Well, what was your interest in meeting them? I mean, admittedly, they're way out there in the reproductive technology community.
But to the extent that they were providing funds for more mainline scientists to do it, you know, I was interested in what criteria they would use to choose people, and they thought smart people should be cloned. And also, they have been mainstreamed. I mean, their scientific director presented at a recent, very prestigious meeting on mammalian cloning that included the top people in the United States doing genetics and gene therapy and so forth. So this is just an example of how quickly we've become almost comfortable with each new technology, the fact that, you know, this group would, you know, become mainstream so quickly.
If you're just joining us, my guest is bioethicist Lori Andrews. We'll continue our conversation after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Lori Andrews. Her new book is The Clone Age, Adventures in the World of Reproductive Technology. We've been talking about perspectives on this technology here in the U.S., but other cultures have been engaging in heated debates about what constitutes parenthood and family in the context of reproductive technology. And Japan last year, for instance, was riled up about the ethics of IVF involving sperm and egg donors. They seem to draw the line there. What lessons do you think are valuable from international experiences of the limits of reproductive technology, what the limits should be?
I think that in England they've had a good approach in that they've had a national agency that reviews these technologies before they get put in place and actually licenses the clinics so that they can make some decisions, collect follow-up data, and so forth. And they have come up with rules that say things like no human cloning, no collection of sperm from dead men without their consent. And I think that having that kind of monitor allows the couples, you know, choosing these technologies to feel safer, to feel like they'll be less subject to potential abuses than have occurred in this country where, you know, for example, at a Virginia clinic, a doctor told his patients he was giving them anonymous donor sperm, but instead used his own sperm, or in California, where there are allegations that a doctor stole embryos from certain couples and gave them without the first couple's knowledge or consent to recipients who thought they were from legitimate donors. So I think that's a good model, but I think we have a lot to learn from our neighbors to the north, from Canada, where they created a governmental commission where they really tried to figure out what Canadian values were, and they had anthropologists and philosophers do studies, but they had, you know, 800 number phone lines where people who had had experiences could call in and talk about what had gone wrong or right, and the this Commission on Reproductive Technologies in Canada did come up with some guidelines based on their own values, things such as forbidding cloning, forbidding paid surrogate motherhood, forbidding crossing species and putting animal genes in humans and so forth. I think that in some countries that's easier to do. In the United States, though, we have less of a shared value set. Our value is more one of the marketplace, more one of show me the money and the technology will be available. But I think at the very, very least, we owe the women and children a much better system for collecting data, seeing what risk the drugs present to women, seeing what risk the techniques present to children, so that we aren't, you know, harvesting the negatives of this in the next generation.
How did you come to specialize in this area of law?
Well, I took my bar exam on the day the first test tube baby was born, and somehow our paths were intertwined. It seemed to me my heroes in law school were women who had argued the contraception and abortion cases before the Supreme Court, and the right of women to make decisions not to have children was very firmly ensconced by the time I graduated from law school. But as a result, women were able to postpone childbearing, go to law or medical school, enter a career, and through postponing childbearing actually diminished their chances of being fertile when they ultimately decided. So my generation of women were the first then that really needed technologies to have babies rather than to not have babies. And so I got involved in it at the very time that cases started coming to the courts about whether women had the right to use things like in vitro fertilization. One early activity of mine was I was at the first world conference after the first birth on in vitro. And through that, I met doctors from around the world who just started calling me up, asking me all their legal questions as they did things like create pregnancies with a sperm donor, egg donor, surrogate mother, and the couple who intended to rear the child. So lots of questions about parenthood, about what appropriate procedures are. In fact, back in 1980 at that first conference, I met for the first time Richard Seed, who's come to light now as a proponent of cloning. And at that early conference, he said he thought we should split embryos in half, grow up the first half, see if it got into Harvard, and then defrost the other half and make its twin later on if the first half was worthy. It's because you can actually split human embryos and make twins. They actually do it with cows all the time. So he was interested in this later-born twin issue even then.
And how did his colleagues receive his ideas?
They weren't quite ready for it at that time, but now some of those technologies are taking place in a lesser way, in that embryos are being split so that you can do genetic screening on them, on one cell that's taken off of the 8-cell embryo, and if the embryo then meets the particular screening standards, the other 7 cells are implanted to make a child. And I think that's changing, actually, the decisions that couples make about reproduction. While you might not abort a fetus when it's the only fetus and you've bonded during pregnancy because it is of the, quote, wrong sex, couples who have 10 of their embryos laid out in front of them and can decide whether they want to implant only boys, only girls, make different decisions. So I think the admission standards for birth are being upgraded by pre-implantation screening.
It's interesting that in your work, you're called on in many ways to define what a human being is, to define an embryo, but also not to stay away from defining it, because that would trample on individual rights. Do you feel that push and pull in the cases that you've worked on?
Yes, because in some cases, it would be to my advantage to think of embryos as persons. In one case I handled in Virginia, the couple wanted to move the embryo to their new doctor, and the original clinic said, no, you can't have it back. So if we'd said, well, that's embryo's a person, you've kidnapped it, it would have benefited my clients, and yet it would have wreaked havoc in other areas of law, such as in the abortion area, if we consider an embryo to be a person. So there is that straddling of how do you value embryos, which couples have strived so very hard to create, which are, you know, central to their plans to become parents, without giving embryos so many rights that, in fact, women's rights are totally trampled upon.
You're a mom.
You
have a child?
I have a 10-year-old who thought of the name of this book, The Clone Age.
Did you work through your pregnancy?
Yes.
And were you litigating cases involving parental rights and rights to embryos
while
pregnant?
And in fact, I was writing a book on surrogate motherhood and reading things for that book that I never would have read as just a pregnant woman about how, for example, the experiences you have during pregnancy affect the child's whole life. It's sort of like Freud starting at an even earlier age. You can, you know, ruin your child completely if you aren't putting little headphones on your belly to play at classical music while you're pregnant. So my work and my life have been at interesting junctures.
Did you find that people, colleagues or professionals in the court, as you argued a case, responded differently to you as you went about your work when pregnant?
Yes. In fact, I had testified in Congress saying that surrogate motherhood should not be banned. And so some of the groups, for example, the attorney for Mary Beth Whitehead, the surrogate who changed her mind, actually came up to me and said, sell me your baby. The idea was that if you were going to allow surrogate motherhood at all, you had to be willing to be a surrogate, which is a totally, you know, outrageous idea. Also, I found a big reaction from the infertility doctors who I had been lecturing to, you know, telling them to get informed consent from women who felt they now could sort of scare me and tell me, oh, you're not going to be able to work, that baby's going to be pressing against you, you know, and causing all this discomfort and risk and so forth. So they tried to use their knowledge over me during pregnancy.
I think what a lot of people find difficult to swallow about the burgeoning reproductive technology industry is this sense of entitlement that people feel to take advantage of whatever is there. If it can be done, it should be done, and I have a right to do it if I can pay for it. I suppose that's part of what people mean when they talk about a lot of these techniques as not being natural, being not accepting your destiny. Do you find yourself fighting that prejudice or the idea that people's entitlement to this technology is out of balance?
I think that there are lines to be drawn, and I think that, you know, people are entitled to try to have a child, but not to be guaranteed a child, and I think that's a big, big difference. You know, for example, I can understand someone's desire to have a genetically related child. I can't understand it when someone chooses an egg donor, a sperm donor, and a surrogate, and so they have no genetic relation, and they're just doing a kind of prenatal adoption. Why not then adopt a child who's out there? And yet this entitlement, saying I have a right to my child, is totally changing the nature of what my means. You know, it's not that couple's biological child. It really has, you know, no relation in that sense. And so I think they are pushing the entitlement too far. And on the flip side, I think physicians are pushing couples too far, keeping them on the roller coaster, because physicians don't like the failure of having a couple who don't create a child. And so they'll keep offering the newest and newest and newest technologies, and couples who want to get off that roller coaster, who want to come to terms with their fertility problems or to adopt a child, aren't really given that opportunity. I also have found in this area, I was surprised. I went into it thinking, well, all this is being fueled by couples who want a genetic link to their child, and that's understandable. But as I interviewed couples, and I interviewed about 80 in surrogate mother clinics, I found many of them did not necessarily want to have a child through that procedure, but they had tried adoption, and they'd either been on the waiting list so long, or they'd reached an age where they weren't being considered, or some were turned down because they were mixed religions, or the child was of a different race. And so I think we could get away from some of that entitlement by reconsidering what we're doing in the adoption area, since many, many of these couples just want to be parents and not necessarily want to have the control over the children that the genetic and reproductive technologies seem now to offer.
Laurie Andrews, thanks very much for being my guest on Fresh Air today.
My pleasure.
Laurie Andrews' new book is The Clone Age. She heads the Institute for Science, Law, and Technology at Chicago Kent College of Law. Coming up, Milo Miles reviews a new album from the psychedelic band Olivia Tremor Control. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back.
Music critic Milo Miles is not really an old hippie, but he is a sympathizer. And so he was interested in the curious persistence of psychedelic rock and roll. He recently went to a show by a young head trip band, the Olivia Tremor Control, and has since tried to understand how these musicians connect with their audience at a time when drugs aren't such a part of the concert scene.
It's a pop music truism that every type of rock and roll exists in the 90s and that no one style matters more than another. All that counts is sales, big or small, and audience, influential or out of it. But every audience is a philosophy at large in the land. One that has fascinated me for 30 years is what might be called the psychedelic crowd. Of course, the media focuses on this audience from time to time, mostly because it's assumed to be a bunch of dope fiends. I'm more interested in who are the people who enjoy rock music as a means to zany introspection, for the pleasure of whimsical sounds, and for catchy songs that are not directly concerned with relationships, crummy jobs, political injustice, and material goodies. For many years, the symbol of the psychedelic rock experience has been the huge outdoor tribal whoop, sponsored by bands like the Grateful Dead or Phish. The crowds who flock to such events are a mixture of charming and pathetic, and while I think people dismiss them too easily, the tribal whoopers are certainly not in touch with the times. But there's a quieter, more private kind of psychedelic rock that extends back to the mid-period Beatles and delightful 60s albums like Forever Changes by the group Love. It is this tradition that attracts young bands like Olivia Tremor Control of Athens, Georgia. Their recent second album, Black Foliage, is a head trip for today. Olivia Tremor Control songs are quick-changing, using heavy studio technology but few high-tech instruments. Pretty harmonies and a guitar hook give way to a squealing saxophone or a tape loop before a clarinet drone takes over. Some of the group's tunes are short, very short, short. And though connected moving parts make some tracks lengthy, there are no epic expositions. Mixing a whiff of the otherworldly with the everyday is part of Olivia Tremor Control's appeal. The material is goofy but smart, with a carefully worked out casual feel. That's also a good description of the sellout crowd at a recent Olivia Tremor Control show at the Middle East Club in Cambridge, Massachusetts. There were a few floppy hats and overalls and maybe a few more beards than usual, but this is music for the mainstream college crowd with a sensitive side. That fellow Beck is the tech trickster wizard of this bunch. Elliot Smith is the brooding poet. Olivia Tremor Control don't exactly run a tight ship. There's too much throwaway material on their records, too many lyrics about dreams and looking out windows, too many tracks that don't seem strictly necessary as songs. But at the Middle East, a love of playing with sound just poured out of guitarist and singer Bill Doss and the four other band members. The crowd pressed close to the stage like kids at a magic show. It's a healthy reminder that rock began as serious fun before it became a trip to the dark night of the soul or aggression with a leer. Olivia Tremor Control strive to keep their music trips friendly and light, sometimes clownish but rarely sappy. At the Middle East show, they obviously captured fans' hearts by making head music that depended on strong singing and well-blended harmonies rather than awesome instrumental technique or marathon solos. As ever, you start more dreams with pretty melodies and sweet voices than you do with hot chops and heavy concepts.
Milo Miles is music editor at Soundstone.com. Today's senior producer is Roberta Shorrock. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Kathy Wolf. Bob Purdick is our engineer. Alan Tu directed today's show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Fox Searchlight Pictures and Regency Enterprises, presenting the updated romantic comedy William Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream. This film opens May 7th in select cities. From Barnes & Noble, featuring the traditional Cuban songs of the Buena Vista Social Club on Nonesuch Records. Available at Barnes & Noble music locations. And from Back Bay Books, publishers of Philistines at the Hedgerow, Passion and Property in the Hamptons by Stephen Gaines. Available in paperback and as a Time Warner audiobook. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, more of our favorite interviews from the past. Tune in tomorrow to find out who it'll be. Join us for the next Fresh Air.